In a world where podcasts are something of a dime a dozen, and literary podcasts even less so, one man by the name of Bat Segundo reached his 25th podcast. He was shocked by this. Having worked for so long for so little, Mr. Segundo decided that getting the young roving correspondent to interview a guest that he had talked with before was the only tenable option for this dubious silver anniversary. He looked through the Rolodex. Octavia Butler? Dead, I'm very sorry to say. Bret Easton Ellis? Perhaps a tad too angry. Dave Barry? The man wouldn't return his calls after that incident with the Chronicle reporter. Who, pray tell, could it be? But there was one dependable man who would agree to talk with our young roving correspondent again. One man who wasn't above talking with some balding literary bastard from San Francisco. Jonathan Ames. A writer both witty and scatological. Surely he'd agree to sit through our young roving correspondent's shaky questioning and tedious asides. Jonathan Ames. Surely he'd remember. He had written repeatedly about his rectal itch. He had bared his soul for the New York Press. And by Jove, he had a new essay collection out. Jonathan Ames. He'd be the man to give this podcast credibility. And so, an email or six later, Mr. Ames returned to talk with our young roving correspondent. Meeting in a murky hotel room, the two men got to the bottom of things. Together, the two men battled against evil foes within their mind and unearthed skeletons in the closet. Well, not really. They did have a rather curious conversation that follows in a trice.
Okay, I am here with the Bat Segundo Show's first repeat guest, Mr. Jonathan Ames. I'm honored that you're the first guest who has appeared twice on this program.
Oh, I didn't know that I was a redux or a repeat. Or suddenly that made me think of when you eat something and then it comes up later.
I'm glad that you made such a memorable impression.
Not in a good way, though. That's not good. But thank you for having me on again. Wow.
Well, thank you for being here. So this time, we talked last time about your fiction, so we'll talk a little bit about your nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Before we get into that, I actually want to discuss the book cover, which is metaphorical in some sense. But anyway, there's a certain sort of revelation there on the cover. Was this accidental?
I'll elaborate. Yes, it was accidental. I got the final book, and I looked at it, and the cover of the book features myself running down a road in the Catskills in a pair of boxer shorts with a suitcase and a fedora. This was a picture that had been taken of me a year before for a photo shoot. And on the back of the book shows me fully clothed. When I had done this for a photo shoot for a magazine, I said, hey, it'd be funny if I'm running down a street with my clothes on. Then let's shoot the same spot, but I'm running down in my underwear, and it'll be like a narrative. He's got his clothes on, now he doesn't. What happened to this guy? The magazine only used the one where I'm fully clothed. And then fast forward a year later, or 2 years later, whenever it was, I guess a year later, I have this book coming out. They're coming up with bad jackets for the book, and I remembered this photo shoot. I thought, this is perfect, because I have a number of travel pieces and, you know, the suitcase. So, okay, they go for it. We find the photographer. The front of the book, it's just like this idea I had, except reversed. The front of the book shows me in the underwear, and the back of the book shows me clothed. So it's kind of after and before.
Yeah.
Well, I get the final book. I look at it. I'm like, oh, my God. I think my testicle, or to be more specific, my scrotal sac on the right-hand side is hanging out of the boxer shorts. Or it's a shadow. So I didn't say anything to the publisher because I was like, I don't want them to recall the book, you know, 3 weeks before it comes out.
But it gets out on eBay or something.
You know, but I was just wondering, you know, and then part of me was mortified. Part of me was amused. You know what I mean? It's just so absurd. Also, luckily, it's obscure enough where it's like, is it a testicle or is it a shadow? So sure enough, the book has come out. And then I decided to highlight this all in an email. And I, to my email list, I wrote, ballsy new book from Jonathan Ames, where I then, you know, in full disclosure, as it were, mentioned the testicle. And I thought it would be a funny sort of antidote to all this James Fry, J.T. Leroy scandal. Here's an absolutely, well, not that their scandals had meaning, but here's a totally meaningless scandal, if it is at all a scandal, and it's not. It's just sort of absurd. And as I then have since written on my website, you know, it's my literary career in a nutshell, as it were, or nutsack. And so then the Seattle Stranger, they wrote a review of the book saying he has balls, and they mentioned it, this whole thing. And then I decided while I was doing readings, I'm on a little reading tour, that I should have a poll, because I have noticed that the world seems to be divided between those who think it's a testicle and those who think it's a shadow. Some people are saying it's my penis. I don't know. One person said it was an ass flap. I mean, like, what? An ass flap along my right thigh? I don't know. So, anyway, I'm going to take a poll, just as I once had the most phallic building in the world contest run through my website. I'm now taking a poll. Is it a testicle or is it a shadow? And I wish I had been doing this scientifically from the start, because it's probably about at least over 100 people have weighed in. But now I've started the poll. And if you go to my website, jonathanames.com, and look under readings, news, and performances, you'll see where I discussed the poll. And so I'd say I have about maybe a dozen votes in right now. I don't know what it is. I'd say it's still evenly divided between testicle and shadow.
Wow. Well, you know, I thought it might have been sort of homage to the mangina and how there's some scrotum in the mangina that your pal Harry. Actually.
Right. Well, I consulted him. My friend Harry Chandler, his real name is Patrick Bucklew, but in my books I called him Harry Chandler to protect him a little.
Now he's no longer protected.
No longer protected. I don't know. But in the books, which are permanent, his parents could pick up. And he invented a prosthetic device called the mangina. This was way back in 1998. I've written about him extensively. And the mangina is a prosthetic vagina that he wears as a performance art piece and for general reasons of insanity. He also was someone who used to like to expose his testicles. He wouldn't expose the whole penis, just expose the testicles. But the mangina became a way for him to do it nicely, because he puts a hole in the mangina and pulls out some of his scrotal sac, and it actually does look like labia. Many people are fooled. Well, they're not fooled. They think it's plastic, and then they finger him, and, you know, all hell breaks loose. Not always. A lot of people like fingering him.
Yeah.
It's been fingered by thousands. So I consulted him because this, you know, but I was sort of going into his territory, exposing the balls, and he said it wasn't my ball. But I think he said that only because he was jealous, you know. But
yeah. Well, anyway, this is actually, of the three essay books, this is the only one that you've done with footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, and these footnotes are actually sort of self-promotional to some degree. Uh-huh. I'm wondering if you could sort of explain why you suddenly felt that, you know, felt footnote friendly.
Well, there weren't too many. I forget the instances. Maybe because the footnotes, like with What's Not to Love, you start it, you kind of get to know me, because
yeah.
I kind of shaped it as a memoir, even though they were columns I'd written for New York Press. My Less Than Secret Life, I think, also was explanatory, but there were references that I needed for people to know, you know what I mean? Whether it be characters or the fact that I have a son. So I think those were the instances that I footnoted, or just something that was amusing, I guess, in the case of the writer Mark Danielewski, that, you know, a couple years after I wrote this piece about him having a lump on his forehead, I heard that he had actually gotten it inspected. So it seemed worthwhile mentioning in a footnote. But what were the self-promotional? I don't even remember what the footnotes are.
You know, I don't really either, but...
maybe it's where I say, like, you can read this book. I think it's only one case.
Like, you can go to my site for the phallic building content.
Oh, yeah. Well, that in part was because I originally, in the book, wanted all the pictures of the phallic building contest, kind of like thumbnails, but it was going to be too expensive. So I couldn't do it in the book, but, you know, it was enough just to have two pictures in the book and then direct people to the website so they could see the whole contest.
So you had a quota on the number of photos you could actually put in this book.
Yes. And also with the phallic building contest, there was a whole permissions ordeal, I guess, all those pictures. So it was just, it wasn't possible. Though I think it would have made a very funny little, you know, 5 pages of pictures of phallic buildings, but...
What's to stop you from, like, putting out a chapbook?
I guess, but, you know, I don't have that much energy. So, but, you know, it's all on the website anyways.
Okay. Yeah, actually, I wanted to talk about how much you reveal as an essayist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, here in San Francisco, we've got Josh Kornbluth, who I'm sure you're familiar with, who did Haiku Tunnel, and he's does a whole bunch of theatrical monologues. But he says, I will never write, or I will never do anything involving my wife or my family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you have any sort of personal limits of what you will not write about or what you will not talk about.
Yes, I mean, Also, I should say that ultimately I prefer fiction. This was a question that I was asked at Powell's, because in some ways I feel I can be more honest in fiction, or I can go places that I maybe can't go in nonfiction. My general rule, I don't necessarily have a rule, I won't write about my wife or family. And in this case, I don't have a wife. But my general rule is I don't want to hurt anyone.
Yeah.
So there's certain things that maybe I won't reveal about someone that perhaps would make a good story. Or maybe there's certain things I don't want to reveal about myself that if somebody read it, that they would then be hurt. You know what I mean? So it's, you know, I put a lot out there, maybe more than most people would, but I'm just trying to always be very careful. That's my stomach grumbling, if you heard that on the podcast. Not to hurt anyone as best I can. I mean, writers obviously have to be somewhat fearless. I mean, I was worried with one of my novels that someone might recognize a character based on them. And then this other writer, Hal Sirowitz, a poet, said to me, I think quoting Nadine Gordimer, but maybe it wasn't Nadine Gordimer, that you have to write as if you're dead, you know, where you don't care what anybody thinks. But that's my parameters, that I don't want anyone to be hurt either by something I might have written about them, or if I write something about me, which could then hurt or upset them.
But it's also very interesting because I note, for example, in your essays that you write about your girlfriends only after the breakup has actually mm-hmm. happened, mm-hmm. which I find interesting. And yet there was a recent sort of nerve piece that you did in the bad mm-hmm. sex thing in which mm-hmm. you were a little bit more revelatory about mm-hmm. like sex in that kind of mm-hmm. sort of capacity. And I found that to be sort of an interesting change for you. I'm wondering if like the barn doors here are sort of opening up or...
Well, that nerve piece got sort of weakened because there's a first half to that piece, which nerve didn't end up using. And I might have written the second half differently, you know, because when you're dealing with word count, and the first half is all about these two virgins I didn't sleep with in my early youth. But GQ, luckily, I was able to cut that piece in half, is going to publish that in April. I feel a little bit bad about that nerve piece. That was a piece where I did worry that maybe the individuals might feel bad.
Anyway, so, there was a brief phone call there, right. And we were talking about the nerve piece and about whether the barn doors here have swung open and how it got sort of split into two individual essays. Actually, you know, so you got two sales for the price.
Yeah, no, I was actually pleased with that because GQ pays a lot more than Nerve. Yeah, I mean, for the most part, that's something I've not written about girlfriends while I had them. Certainly when I had the column, I didn't write too much about my girlfriend. So I guess there were some columns I did, if I think back on it. I had this girlfriend and I wrote about a trip to Maine we took in one of the books, which originally, of course, was a column, then put in a book. But yeah, so I've tried to be protective of the women in my life. I guess I sort of have like this thing, expiration, you know what I mean? Cause like this virginity story in Nerve took place about 6-7 years ago. So I felt kind of like enough time had passed, but I, at the same time, I felt a little funny, like that. I just hope no one would be hurt or offended by it. So.
You mentioned in our...
But it was such an absurd story. I had never written it. And that the story that we're talking about in Nerve, I was in bed with a dark-haired girlfriend. She discovered the long blonde hair of someone else I had just been in bed with. And at the time, I had a comb-over, and I had blonde hair. And I tried to pretend that it was my hair, but in draping it with the other strands of the comb-over, it went from my ear to about my hip. And so it was obvious that it was not my long blonde hair, which had been discovered in the bed. Yeah. So,
well, you mentioned also in our previous interview, mm-hmm. when we were talking about fiction versus nonfiction, the same sort of priority.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that you felt that many of your nonfiction pieces were tossed off, or that you didn't expend mm-hmm. nearly as much effort in them mm-hmm. as you did with your fiction mm-hmm. pieces. I'm wondering, since there was also the Morning News piece mm-hmm. recently, and mm-hmm. there seems to be a sort of resurgence in nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And actually, when reading this book, I was like, wow, actually, Jonathan's been writing a lot of nonfiction over the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, I'm still always asked, hey, can you write something? You know what I mean? For different magazines, and so to make money and to keep it going. I mean, a couple pieces, though, I just sort of independently wrote. Well, I mean, I guess the refrigerator piece... the New York Times humor section asked me for something, and so I tried to write something for them, and it didn't work. And so then I gave it to the Morning News. Then the body falling apart piece, which is at the end of this book, I guess I just sort of wrote that one day and got Slate to publish it. For the most part, though, it's been a response to people coming to me and saying, hey, can you write something, you know, and needing the money I have, so, which is great. And I mean, I enjoy writing these pieces, but, you know, with the fiction, I definitely spend more time and care over the sentences and the whole thing. And it takes years to produce a novel, whereas these pieces usually are written in a day, maybe edited the day later, submitted. Maybe an editor makes a few changes and then that's it, you know.
But if you feel that they're tossed off, does this kind of grow tiresome or tedious for you as a sort of creative artist that you're kind of, you know, in your view, tossing these off as opposed to sort of working out a draft over, you know, many months?
Well, did I use the word tossed off? I mean, that maybe is a bad term, but I don't know that it grows tedious. I mean, there's something fun to trying to be real quick and declarative and hit your mark right away. You know what I mean? And so that's a fun challenge. And I do enjoy these pieces a lot of times. Like in September, I did a piece on the U.S. Open for the New York Observer, which didn't make it into this book, but it was a piece I was really proud of. Like, I had a couple of passages there which, you know, first time down were working nicely and were rather poetic, and the language was, I felt good about the language. I think it's this feeling of sometimes I see the pieces and I haven't worked them over enough and I don't feel as good about them as I might with the fiction, where I've really tried to hone it and as best I can. That's why ultimately I do prefer fiction. Though the nonfiction, there is the fun of the immediacy. Okay, I got an assignment, like The Stranger asked me to write a review of the reading I gave the other night in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, can I write it in a day and be funny and quick and, you know, do it in 700 words? You know, it's a challenge.
Well, there's also, in this book, I noticed that there's a certain kind of wistfulness that seems to be kind of crouching up. Right. Anyway, there's a wistfulness that kind of is coming forward and is pronounced in this book that more so than the other two. Like, for example, like the Falling Apart essay, the midlife assessment.
Right.
That, to me, struck me as a very sort of sad essay, particularly because you didn't reveal one pivotal sort of body part, and that was your heart. And I think that all along there's this sort of undercurrent of how your heart feels about various sort of things. I'm wondering if you can sort of elaborate upon this about there's this sort of pronounced quality to be emotional that is now. Do you feel that you're trying to, you know, break out of like this retread of this kind of banging out an essay in a day kind of mentality? Or
I think it's more, and I guess other people have noticed this, and I guess I didn't notice it so much. You know what I mean? Like, where you don't hear your own voice or see yourself the way other people do. And I guess there's a number of pieces there towards the end of the book, because I set up the book chronologically, which were written in sad modes or sad moods, and yet I still had an assignment. Like, there's a piece about the breakup, which is called Ourselves Between Us. The original title was Mixtape, because it was for a music magazine called Filter, and I was supposed to write an opinion piece, and my opinion on anything. And at the moment when I had the assignment, well, the opening line I wrote, it is my opinion that I'm rather heartbroken. You know what I mean? I could have written an opinion on something in the country, but I wrote about this opinion I had because that was the mood I was in. And the falling apart, maybe. So it's almost been timing that when I've had to write a few essays here and there, it's been in a low mood. And whether it be a breakup or aging or... I mean, I look back at some of the stuff I wrote for New York Press that's in my book, What's Not to Love, My Less Than Secret Life. I don't remember writing these pieces, but they're really funny and over the top and outrageous and kind of honest. And I wish I could sort of write those again. Or, like, I've been reading this one. I had a number of readings. I read Bald, Impotent, and Depressed, which I wrote in 1998. And as an oral piece written out loud, it really is like a laugher. And I don't know if I could write that kind of piece now for whatever reason. You know what I mean? You change as a writer, and that's why I want to try to start writing a novel again, or, you know.
But you were the first man to say erection at the Princeton Club, so.
Yeah. What did I do?
You wrote this in, I believe.
In 2000. Yeah.
The second book.
My Less Than Secret Life. I wrote that piece in 99. Yeah. Because I had just given a talk on the extra man there. Yeah. A controversy broke out at the Princeton Club between some members, you know.
Now erection can be unleashed in all variety of environments here.
Yeah.
The 11 pieces of the 30 in this book are actually from the New York Press Home. Mm-hmm. I was curious why they didn't make it into the other two books. Many of them actually involving your penis, too. So.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, this book, there's too much about the penis, too much body stuff. So I have some misgivings, but there's a number of good pieces in there, and so yeah. I'm sort of buoyed by that. And I guess I wanted to put another book out there. I think if there's 11 pieces from New York Press, now you know the book better than I do at this point, only the first, I think, three or four were actual columns. After that, I stopped writing the column in 2000,
yeah.
But I continued sporadically to just every now and then submit an essay. And so those first three or four, which are like from 98, I think, for some reason, when someone who was helping me with What's Not to Love, an editor's assistant, like cut one or two of them, and I went along with it, and then I rediscovered them in my computer, and I'm like, oh, they're pretty good.
Those were the three that I was laughing off on the bus when I told you, and I got strange looks from people.
Right. So I was just like, oh, and I was glad I found them in my computer and could resuscitate them. So I think it was merely that. Also, the book What's Not to Love was getting a little long or something, and so some pieces got cut, and those were the pieces that got cut. But I restored those, and then the subsequent New York Press pieces all occurred after What's Not to Love and My Less Than Secret Life had been put together, mm-hmm. I guess, because they were written like 2002, a couple of them 2003, like the Tyson one was 2003. The one about can edit this while I'm trying to think out loud.
So did you laugh later in the book though too, other than those first?
I did laugh. I just found myself more. It was interesting to me this kind of really sort of somber, introspective feel I got from like the a lot of these I had read before also, so I didn't quite laugh because I had
right you read them on yet. McSweeney's exactly, or something like exactly. that. Yeah, well, the first five. Are from my column. Those are old columns. I called myself El Cid. It was actually not a column. It was like for a sports issue that New York Press had. But it might have been during the period when I was writing the column. So, yeah, all those, for some reason, didn't make it into What's Not to Love or My Less Than Secret Life. Either they got cut or, in the case of some of them, I didn't. I remember Rue Saint-Denis, for some reason I didn't like it at one time, but then I reread it and I kind of liked it, so I put it back in. Everything after those first six were later New York Press writings. Gotcha. But the pieces I like in this book, I also like you. I like the first four. My wiener is damaged. I have mixed feelings about it, but I like the first four because they're in that old flavor of the column, and I was just being so nutty back then, just writing whatever. And I like my new society testimony, Able to Love Again. That has some funny lines. Self-sentence works all right. I like I Love You More Than You Know. That's about my great aunt.
How is she doing, by the way?
She's in a nursing home now. Okay. She's no longer in her apartment, but she's doing all right. And I showed her this book because it's dedicated to her, and she liked that. And she said, "You're so good to me." And she started crying.
Aww.
And I like Everybody Dies in Memphis. I like No Contact Asshole. There's parts of Horror's Writer and A Pimple, My Trip to Europe that are good. You know, that whole description of the banana bar. Club Existential Dread has some good moments. The Loose Tiles piece, I think, is kind of good in a melancholy way. I like A Tribute to George Plimpton because I think my affection for him really comes across. I like Ourselves Between Us. And then She Said, He Said is kind of funny for dealing with the transsexual issue.
I actually wanted to ask you about that. There's this thing that...
I guess there's some good pieces in here, right? You know what I mean? For a paperback and...
Don't worry. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about She Said, He Said. Have you read the interview that Glenn Gould did with himself?
Glenn Gould?
Glenn Gould, yeah.
Pianist?
Yes.
No.
I actually have a copy, but I'll give it to you. But this reminded me very much of that, actually. I had to ask you. It's like, is he doing Glenn Gould here?
I mean, it's a thing that many people have done. I don't know what gave me the idea to do it exactly. It was something like, I forget the editor at Book Forum, who I wrote that for, was like, why don't you write something about your transsexual book? And I'm like, well, what could I write other than what I already put in the introduction, you know? So then I somehow came up with the idea of interviewing myself. And then, you know, I had a fight with myself, and you know what I mean?
Of course.
And so that, I thought that piece is kind of all right, because it sort of talks about the tranny issue. And then the piece that ends the book for The Onion, that's kind of a funny little quick piece. So I'd say, yeah, about 60% of this book is okay.
So
the rest is fair to middling.
So this is for listeners who have not bought the book.
Oh, buy it. There's a lot of good stuff in there. But I mean, people seem to be responding positively to it, you know, which is good. And I don't know. I don't know why I'm being self-denigrating. I probably shouldn't. It does have a great cover, though. And, you know, and not every book by a writer can, you know, Paul Auster, you know, every now and then one of his books isn't so great, you know, but I still read them and then looked forward to the next.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm putting myself down. It's probably bad.
Well,
I guess I'm being honest.
No, that's good. But I mean, let's talk about this. Cause I mean, you know, again, when you had mentioned this book to me the last time we talked, you specifically said these are sort of throwaway pieces. These are sort of like, you know, these are pieces that have not yet been published in book form. I'm kind of sort of assembling these together, which is fine because every writer has that one book of leftovers.
I did that a little in my Less Than Secret Life, too. I'm like, I have been writing quite a lot, you know, six books. That's not bad.
Yeah. So, you know, but I wanted to talk again about this sort of this nonfiction thing about why you keep writing nonfiction. I mean, beyond the obvious sort of way to kind of keep yourself alive and keep yourself, you know, keep a roof over your head and the like. You know, your next couple of projects are a graphic novel, I understand, as well as screenplay of The Extra Man. And I'm wondering, what about fiction? If fiction is the thing that really sort of, you know, strikes your light, so to speak, then, you know, what's been happening on that front? And why sort of the nonfiction are tossed off as opposed to the, let's talk laboring versus tossed off.
Well, again, it's not so much the phrase tossed off is, again, dismissive. It really is a practical issue of making money in the moment and getting assignments. And or sometimes every now and then writing something that's of a length, knowing that it could be published on the internet or a magazine. But really, it's this thing of living as a writer. Many writers, always novelists, would do lots of freelance work. I mean, Graham Greene for years wrote movie reviews. You know what I mean? Yeah. And until you can get to the place where you can just write fiction, you got to hustle and survive. And luckily for me, I enjoy writing the nonfiction, and I have fun with it, and I know it gives people some laughs, and so that's pleasing. And then I get to make books out of it. But I love to read novels, you know what I mean? And so ultimately that's what I'd like to do. Now the graphic novel came up because I have this friendship with the illustrator Dean Haspiel, and he really wanted to do something together. And then, so we met an editor and I sort of pitched an idea and then I wrote an outline and it's sort of happening. And I'm intrigued by the form and mostly, you know, and I want to do something with my friend, you know, and I think it could be cool. And that's kind of going to be a blurring of fiction and nonfiction. It's going to take some real life binges I've had and sort of frame a story around it. Mm-hmm. And I mostly just want to see what my friend Dean will do, you know, make images out of this thing. So luckily graphic novels won't take that long to write because you don't put that much on a page. You know, it's actually very little. I've seen graphic novels and, you know, it's literally maybe a quarter of a page of prose. Mm-hmm. So I think I can do that like in a month because I have the outline is already formed.
Are you actually like, because for typical comic book scripting, like, you know, it depends on the writer, but are you been, you know, doing a lot of scripting in terms of what each panel will look like?
I haven't started yet because we're waiting for the contract to be finalized. But I have a very like 12-page thorough outline, which I imagine I'll amend, but Yeah, I mean, Dean is a really great artist. He just did Harvey Pekar's The Quitter. So I will say, like, what I think is in a panel. You know, I've seen how they script these things, and I have to look at it again to really familiarize myself. But he'll also really go with it. You know, I might say, I enter a bar.
Yeah.
You know, and then Dean will do the rest. You know what I mean?
Check out, actually, this would be good for you. Neil Gaiman in the Sandman bound volumes. Right. I think it's in the second volume. He actually has a sample script.
Mm-hmm.
And you read this and you're sort of stunned, like, oh, you know, it's just like a guy rambling on his typewriter, on his computer, you know, putting these things in. I mean, it's very specific, but at the same time, it's very surprisingly conversational. Just to sort of, you know.
Yeah, no, I know. That's what I'm saying. It's not, the labor is not that great. Now, I'm going to have to, you know, the dialogue I want to make good, and the little narration, you know, I want to be quick and funny. So, you know, that's going to take some art. But so again, that's a project that won't take very long. It'll take him much longer to draw it than for me to write it. And like I said, it's half written already because it's outlined.
Are you much of a comics reader? Or?
I was as a kid, and because of my friendship with Dean, I've now read a couple of graphic novels. You know, I like the form, and so, yeah, I think it'll be fun. And the Extra Man screenplay, I'm also almost done. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of hoping by late spring, summer, that I might be free to start a novel, okay. You know? And I also got hired to write a screenplay, and so I finished that. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to survive, and then hopefully there'll be some money in the bank and I could just try to write some fiction for a while.
Gotcha. No more nonfiction slips to the...
Well, but that can always be fun, like if something totally outrageous happens and it seems like something I want to use in a nonfiction essay as opposed to fiction, you know, then I could do it. Or if New York Observer says, hey, there's a professional boxing match, can you go cover it? You know what I mean?
Can you participate again?
Yeah. You know, then I could have fun with that. You know what I mean? Like Spin Magazine sent me to a Gothic festival in September. You know what I mean? And I was intrigued and I went and wrote a piece, and that's coming out in Spin in April, I think.
Okay.
So I got a couple of pieces coming out. I have a piece in GQ, Spin. What else? Maybe that's it. Seems like there was another one, but maybe that's it. Just those two.
I mentioned another one, and I can't remember either. But maybe it's a false memory. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I guess it's just GQ and Spin.
Okay. Oh, but I wanted to sort of talk about, again, getting back to this issue of like the emotional nature of this nonfiction compared to your other ones. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the sort of the bravado of this early kind of athletic exercise with George Leary and, you know, also, you know, your great aunt, and also coming to terms with your friend's death.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I want to sort of, I'm trying to get a sense of you, I'm trying to get a sense here of what might be motivating this sort of broadening of the emotional...
Well, not to say that you're wrong, but I mean, I don't... like, in my Less Than Secret Life, you know, I wrote The Nista Affair, and I think that was kind of... I mean, it was very... I tried to write as a noir piece, but again, it was sort of tackling something that was serious or odd about my writing being stolen. Or in What's Not to Love, I wrote about... a first love I had and an abortion that we went through. And or I wrote about my parents being in a car accident and meeting my son for the first time. So I think in those other nonfiction books, I have taken on stuff and wrote about stuff that was serious or important to me. You know, maybe there's a more depressed quality, but I feel like what you're trying to say is that I wasn't writing about things that were serious or emotional, and I think that's incorrect.
Well, what I mean to say is perhaps it seems more emotional because as we're sort of kind of clarifying, I think here, you let down your comic guard, meaning, I mean, I was reading a lot of this and saying, wow, this is actually pretty sort of not, I mean, yes, having established that you have in fact written very comic forms to grave subjects, as I believe we talked about in the last time we talked. In this, it seems that the guard came down quite a lot more frequently than I have saw in the other two books.
Yeah.
It was a very sort of straight kind of memoir, more so.
Yeah, I think that's true. I guess, and I didn't mean to sound like a pain in the butt, but I think there's two things. One, I do think that I had written about some serious things and sometimes would change the tone so it wasn't comedic mm-hmm. and What's Not to Love and My Less Than Secret Life. But I think this is the nature of when you write books that make people laugh. They don't remember that every now and then I would change the pitch. They just remember, oh, I shit my pants in the south of France. You know what I mean? They don't remember that there were some actually depressing moments when I would change the tone. That said, in this book, there are some which are just straight. There is no joking around. I guess like the piece about my friend who's dying,
yeah.
It was a straight account of hearing about his death, remembering our friendship, and mourning the fact that I'll never see him again. And the piece about my grandparents also, it was kind of like straight, you know, thinking back. And originally I had written that for this book, Brooklyn Noir.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I just took the word noir literally because mm-hmm. it was kind of me. And I thought I was going to do this thing where I was going to try to find their old house, you know. And I actually had my mother mail me the address in an envelope. And I was just going to try to go to that old neighborhood and walk around and see if I could find it and then open the envelope and get the address, which maybe I'll still do. It's a neat idea. But maybe I ran out of time, so I just wrote this kind of memory piece about my grandparents. Uh-huh. And then the breakup piece was also, it was not at all trying to be comedic. The falling apart piece, actually, I meant for it to be funny, and people took it really seriously. You know what I mean? Which was like, I meant it to be this litany of like kind of whining and over the top whining, and people really took it seriously. I mean, some people laughed, though. Some people seemed to get the humor of it. Other people scolded me, people who emailed me because of Slate, you know, and gay, get off your ass, you know what I mean? And I got all sorts of, you know, people sending me cures and recommendations, and I'm actually quite fit. It was just like I was overemphasizing the problems I do have. You know, everyone's got their little collection of pains and stuff. So,
thought you were on the brink of, like, you know, like that essay that Tim O'Brien wrote after he did Into the Lake of the Woods. He wrote this,
I don't know.
He wrote this New York Times book review essay where basically, like, you know, I'm feeling like really suicidal. And again, similar explorations.
Right.
And he got bombarded with like recommendation for therapists.
Oh, yeah.
You know, are you okay? Are you going to like really kill yourself? That kind of thing.
I know. I really got that. I mean, it sounds like he might have been genuinely depressed.
Yeah, well, he
but,
was definitely, you know. But
So that said, yeah, there are a few pieces here which were straight, you know, me just doing something different. And I guess I probably didn't adopt that tone very much in the columns, which primarily make up the books What's Not to Love and My Less Than Secret Life, because that was like a specific job. Every 2 weeks I was trying to make people laugh.
Yeah.
Though every now and then I would go serious, but it was somewhat rare. Like, for example, I guess in What's Not to Love I have a piece called Crack Up,
mm-hmm.
which when I tell it as an oral story is a very funny story of me smoking crack for the first time, but on the page it's actually a very painful story.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? So every now and then when I would do the columns, I would change the tone. But for most part, it was like sort of like my mandate, or what I want to do every 2 weeks was to make people laugh, which is my natural bent anyways. But here were a few instances where I wasn't writing for New York Press. I'm just writing for Filter and I'm doing an opinion piece. So I just wrote an opinion where I was talking about a lot of pain, you know?
There's also the crime scene cleanup piece in this too.
Right, that was done for Gear magazine, and that had to be written in the voice, you know, of that guy, which is what I did, and that was kind of, I like that piece. You know what I mean? Because it's mm-hmm. just so.
I didn't know
gruesome.
That they actually put the coffee can to like, you know,
mask
the
smells.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So one time after learning that coffee thing,
mm-hmm.
I may have had a moment of near infidelity once, just a kiss and an embrace, but I worried that perfume got on me. So I got a cup of coffee and then spilled it all over my coat because this guy had said that, you know, detectives used coffee to get rid of the odors of dead bodies. So I used coffee to get rid of the smell of perfume.
Isn't that like a little paranoid? Wouldn't you?
I know. I was paranoid. You know, when you.
I mean, you know, it would have been an easy explanation, wouldn't it have been?
I don't know. I was paranoid. I had done something wrong, so I was covering my tracks like an idiot.
Well, the other thing I wanted to talk about was what you, again, going back to the other interview where we were sort of discussing you asked me, like, where do you stand as a writer? Not where do I stand as a writer. But we had kind of gone on this wavelength of talking about, like, I'm Jonathan Ames, I'm a funny man. And I'm wondering if you feel, perhaps, with the current kind of work that you have, whether you are sort of easily falling into the funny man mode, or whether this kind of aspiration to put out, like, a body of novels. I was wondering if you can kind of, you know, in light of what's going on right now with you professionally, you can elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's kind of like very self-involved, navel-gazing sort of question or concern. And I guess I asked you, I was indulging myself, because you're someone who writes so much about the book world and, you know, and one places oneself or not. And really, it's mostly a waste of time to think about these things. But I guess, you know, I mean, some people are just serious novelists because that's all they've put out there, you know, and that's all they're going to be considered. And, you know, and they get a lot of kudos for that, let's say. I've put out 3 novels, all of which I feel have some literary merit, but also because I've put out these essays and maybe have been on Letterman and perform a lot, it creates a different kind of image. I'm not sure what exactly. I don't know. That's why I was trying to ask you.
Yeah.
But I'm pleased with how things are going. Like, I just gave a reading last night in Powell's, and 175 people turned out. I'm like, this is amazing. This is, like, so cool. Like, and most of them had read me before and showed up, and I was just like, you know, slowly something's building, or I don't know what's happening, but it's a pleasure to be able to write books, survive. Some people in the audience last night said, you write a lot about being broke. Are you still broke? You got 6 books out there. And as your audience probably knows, it is hard to make it as a writer, even with 6 books, you know. I'm not on easy street by any means, but I am able to pay the rent, and I got to go on this book tour. I'm in a beautiful hotel room, so it's all really good. I do look forward to producing another book, maybe. I guess I tend to be comedic, but, you know, I look forward to, you know, putting another novel out there in 2 or 3 years and having people be like, whoa, now here's a body of work. He's got these 3 kind of nutty essay collections, some of which sometimes are serious, as we've been discussing, and he performs a lot, and he's done this and he's done that, but he also every now and then puts out an interesting novel that has some good sentences, you know.
Yeah.
But whatever. Again, that's all kind of ego stuff, caring about what people think, and that way caring what they think. You know what I mean? So the main thing is to put out books, because I love to read, I love to make things, and then you give something to people. You know what I mean? So it gives maybe there's some meaning to that existence. So like right now, see, I get distracted by stuff because I have this life as a performer, right? Yeah. And I wrote that TV pilot, and I got to play myself, and I almost became a TV star, but then it fell short. Then just this fall, just for the hell of it, because I was asked by this nightclub, I put together a variety show, you know, which I hosted, and then I would interview the acts afterwards. And it was all these goofy performance art acts that I know from being downtown New York. And then the musician Moby came to one of the shows, and he'd been coming to a number of my monologues, and he proposed to me that we do it at my variety show as a TV show, and he'd like to co-host with me. So now I'm suddenly doing that, and we're putting on 2 shows together end of March, and then he's gonna finance a pilot in April, and we're gonna film it.
Oh, wow.
So, but then it's like, huh, well, if that actually happens, which is a long shot, you know, I'm just going along because it could be fun, and what the heck, you know. When will I have time to write a novel, you know? So I get distracted, but it's a full life, and so I'm not complaining.
What steps do you take to keep the fiction bug alive?
Well, right now, just in my mind or reading books, you know what I mean? I started taking notes on a novel, but then even that stopped. So I'm just sort of hoping that maybe by the summer, you know, I'll be free. There's some research I want to do for this idea of a novel, which I haven't even had the time to do. You know what I mean? Finishing screenplays, getting this book ready, going on a little book tour for it. But so I'm hoping late spring, summer, maybe I would go away. Maybe I could go to Yaddo or someplace, do some research in the spring, and then start writing. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I know that you, for example, are very quick in responding to emails.
Cutting off email would be a great
thing. I'm sort of suggesting, you know, to give you the sort of, I mean, I'm
no, I'm addicted. Myself, I'm addicted to freaking email. I hate email. I got, right now, I'm looking at the computer on the other side of the hotel room. I have like 120 unanswered emails. It just doesn't seem to stop.
I know.
Email is like a tapeworm. I don't know how I can get out from under it, because I both enjoy it, but it's also necessary professionally, you know?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I there's some people, I just like tell people, look, I'll try to respond if I can. I mean, I get all these queries and pitches from publishers.
Right, right.
It's like, I have authors, you know, emailing me. Right. Hey, can I talk? It's like, I can't read, you know, I can't read 16 books a week. I gotta live.
The email stuff is crazy. But between friends and professional stuff, I actually thought, well, tomorrow I'll drink a cup of coffee and try to get through all the emails. I mean, I just did that 2 weeks ago, got it all whittled down to about 20 left. Now it's up to 120 again. It's like, damn. No, I know. Maybe if I just went away for the summer, stopped all email.
Just put like an automatic message. Say, Jonathan Ames is busy writing a novel. Yeah. He will respond to your email possibly in 6 months. I mean, really.
No. That's not a bad idea. I mean, part of it is like, you know, getting an email from an editor at GQ. Hey, can you do a podcast on your piece that's coming out in April?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. You know, I probably won't get paid for that, but still, it's a professional thing to do. Or, you know what I mean? Everyone out in LA, all the communications are email. You know what I mean? It's very hard to, as I'm still trying to pay the rent, you know, I mean, Philip Roth is at the point in his career where he's up in Connecticut and he's, you know, puts the horse blinders on and he just writes novels, you know? I'm still doing all this other stuff, because a lot of it's amusing, like doing this variety show with Moby, you know, but there's a lot of emails for that. You know, emailing the different acts we're gonna get, and email. It is a burden, though. You know, girls writing to me, I want to write them back. You know, come to the website.
How disciplined of a writer would you say you are?
Obviously, I'm not undisciplined because I'm putting stuff out there.
Yeah.
Now, luckily, I think I have a facility with the nonfiction to write the pieces in a day. So then maybe I only write 2 days out of the damn month. But those are two published pieces, and then I put them in a book or something. So for Wake Up, Sir, I worked on that book for 3 years. The bulk of it was written in about 2 months, though, mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or felt like the bulk of it. Maybe it was 3 months. Like I wrote, let's say the whole manuscript was 360 pages. I feel like I wrote 150 pages in 2.5 years and then 210 pages in 6 months. And, you know, sorry, my stomach keeps
I don't think it's
wailing.
Yeah. We've got a pop filter on the mic.
Oh, no, I'm more apologizing to you rather than the audience.
I've seen it all here in San Francisco.
But as all this traveling, and I just had some chicken soup with kreplach at David's here on Geary Street. It's dangerous.
You should try out Dottie's if you want a good breakfast. It's like right around the corner. I'm not sure if you...
Dottie's on Geary?
It's actually... it's on Taylor, I think. Mm-hmm. It's like right really close by. As I was walking up here, I said, oh, Dottie's. I better let Jonathan know. It's a good place.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm not supremely disciplined. Like, if I was disciplined, I wouldn't write so much stupid email and play so much internet backgammon. But I am getting work done, so I can't... you know, flog myself too terribly.
Well, at the same time, though, if you like said, hey, I can set an hour a day to working on a book, do one of those Anthony Trollope kind of situations where he had like the 3 hours he wrote in the morning right before going to the post office.
Mm-hmm.
And like if he finished one book, he would then, you know, like it's at 7:58 or something, at 7:59 he would start the next book.
Yeah. Well, I wish I was like that. I mean, I'm friends with Jonathan Lethem, and I think he's very disciplined that way. I think he really keeps going on the novels. I get distracted, I do waste a lot of time, but you know, I'm not totally displeased, you know. And I for Wake Up, Sorry, I'd shut myself away for like two periods. I went to my parents' house for two, like maybe 6 week periods. Mm-hmm. you know, but I was back and forth to New York a lot, but just to finish the book, edit it, clean it up, you know, get it done.
Is there a society of Jonathans that you would like to comment upon in terms of writers named Jonathan? Well, it's now getting a lot more press these days, but maybe you mentioned Jonathan Lethem being...
Well, I have a mention of it in one of the essays here called Self-Sentence, which was me writing about my career at that point in 2002 for Book Forum. And at the time, I wrote about the Jonathans.
Yeah.
And it was sort of before anybody else had brought it up.
Yeah.
I was aware of it. And then that paragraph ended up getting cut for word count reasons by Book Forum.
Uh-huh.
But I luckily had the paragraph saved, so I kept it and then resuscitated it for this book. It was just me sort of noting, like, well, okay, there was Lethem, Franzen, Jonathan D., Jonathan Coe. And at the time, Jonathan Safran Foer had just sold Everything is Illuminated. I was like, oh, man. And, of course, in a self-deprecating mode, I'm like the weird Jonathan, as I wrote in the book, who's... You know, I guess I was equating it to the Brothers Karamazov. I'm the weird Jonathan who goes staggering off into the woods and is screwing sap poles and trees and then is brought back and lashed by the Russian father. But I guess that's all I have to say about the Jonathans is what I did say, just sort of making a joke of it or something.
Yeah. LA is the site actually did, over the course of a week, they did a sort of a guide to understanding all the writers named Jonathan. Not
who did that?
I think it was the LAist.
Oh, I saw something about that.
Yeah, you were mentioned. Yeah. You know, they were. It was sort of like a guide to which Jonathan you should have for whatever kind of mood that you were in.
That's oh, really? Maybe send me that link. I saw something about the Jonathans, and I guess I saw something about me, and then Time Out New York did something about them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm lucky I get lumped in there. That's cool, you know, because I guess I'd be... could be excluded, and I'll be like, I'm a Jonathan too.
If there's a memo here, if there's a note to learn, if you want to get into writing, change your first name to Jonathan.
Well, I don't know about that, but in that same piece though, I said I should change my name to last name to Franzen,
because
at the time the corrections had come out and was really huge, and in the way that everyone nowadays is saying James Fry, James Fry, James Fry, you know, in a negative way, back then everyone was talking about Jonathan Franzen, and every now and then I guess a writer really is spoken about a lot. You know, I guess when Dave Eggers first came out with Heartbreaking Work, Franzen, I guess Foster Wallace at one time.
Still is.
Yeah, but I'm talking about there's a period of time when a writer is very much the writer of the moment, you know, or where they really emerge and then they stay up there forever, let's say, in the case of Foster Wallace and Franzen and Eggers.
I don't know about Franzen, though. He seems to kind of be, I mean, he hasn't put out a new book other than that How to Be Alone book.
Yeah, but I think he made it hit such a home run with the corrections, so I haven't read it, that I still think, you know, in the way that another time period, I don't know, you know, that he seems like a heavyweight writer, you know what I mean?
Corrections was like 5 years ago.
I guess it was 2001, you're right, that's true, yeah. So
I don't know, I wonder, he's still up there, I still talked about
stories. Right, I guess he's got to come out with another book soon, yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting, let's see if...
You've been more prolific than Jonathan Franzen. You're the most prolific Jonathan Franzen.
No, Lethem.
Lethem's the man, but you're a good and solid number two there, I'd say.
Well, six books, that's not insubstantial. I mean, I am pleased with that because I had such a struggle to write a second book. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like that now, you know. And I did write one book under a pseudonym, Spencer John, so I sort of have seven. But I didn't come up with the story because that was a novelization of a film called 200 Cigarettes. Yeah. So.
Okay, well, I know you have to get off somewhere.
All right. Did you exhausted your questions?
Let me see what I have here. Oh, yeah, there's one last question.
All right.
In living your life,
mm-hmm.
do you ever sort of consciously sort of like live your life in a way as to say, I want to try this so I can write about it later?
I certainly did when I was writing the column. The most specific example I can think of is a friend of mine called me up and asked it for assistance with a sacrifice of a chicken. She was really into voodoo. And I'm not into hurting animals, and I'm sort of a lapsed vegetarian, and there's no way I wanted to assist in that. But then I remember at the time thinking, that would make a really good column. So sure enough, you know, I went. And then same thing with sometimes these goofy assignments, you know, like Spin Magazine. At first I was like, I don't want to go to a gothic music festival. And then I thought, wait, that'd be fun, mm-hmm. you know, or strange. and I went. Or same thing with covering the U.S. Open. That's why I want to. I like covering sports because then I like a chance to write about it, you know, in a different way. And the same thing in like in this book, writing about the Mike Tyson Lennox Lewis fight.
Well, the other thing about sports is that you're not writing about yourself. You're writing about what's happening.
Yeah, and but I also like that thing of trying to do the. Whether it be the Plimpton, Terry Red Southern, kinda,
yeah.
You know, putting yourself somewhat in the action while describing it. You know what I mean? A little bit of a balance of that. But, yeah, I mean, at some point I outgrew the thing of, you know, when I was researching The Extra Man, I was spending a lot of time in these very dark transsexual bars, and part of it was out of my own madness, and part of it was out of, like, looking for material to write about. Now if I do something strange and perverted, I'm usually doing it just because of unusual appetites or something, you know what I mean? Because I've written about it enough, and so, you know, there's no point in writing about it anymore. There goes my stomach again. But, so, yeah, I think now it's more like the occasional trying to get into an odd world to write about, and usually sports, I guess. So that's my life, my little life that I'm trying to lead. And it's a crazy world. And you feel like a fool, you know, out there humping your silly books. But I do bring people some pleasure and laughter. So it's not a total waste.
But do you bring yourself pleasure?
Very rarely. I'm really into these beautiful shoes I bought. They're Clark Wallabies, you know, classic. But they're so comfortable, and I just keep looking at them, and I even talk to them in baby talk or something. I've totally misplaced affections, but so they give me pleasure. And I've had some pleasure on this book tour, just meeting some fun people and just enjoying the hotel rooms. And I've been like an idiot collecting all the soaps because I'm bald, and I never buy things like soap or something. The only soap I ever get to use is what I get from hotels. And I've been staying in really nice hotels, and so I've been stocking up on all this really nice soap. And now I've got this big plastic bag of all these soaps from these different hotels, and
how
I'll take it.
How many bars of soap?
I don't know, at least a dozen plus tubes of moisturizer. I never use moisturizer, but I'm getting all this nice Avita moisturizer in all these hotels, and so I'm enjoying that. That gives me pleasure.
But does writing give you pleasure?
Writing gives me pleasure. Trying to make a good sentence. You know, trying to capture something, you know. Yeah. When I sit down to write, I often enjoy it. And then sometimes my stupid life gets so busy between email and performing or whatever else I do that I really look forward to when I get a chance to sit down and write, you know. It's like, oh, okay, this is really how I should be spending my time, you know. Huh. So I don't get to do it enough, but maybe I'll calm things down. I can do it more. Even going on a book tour, you got to answer a lot of emails and help organize and, you know, just you and I figuring out, okay, let's meet at 6 o'clock. You know, that was like a dozen emails or half a dozen emails, you know?
Yeah.
But it's necessary somehow.
Okay. Well, I will let you live your life.
No, but I'm just saying, like, I like talking to you, but that's just like, you know what I'm saying? Just for a book tour, because then that's some guys come in here Monday and, you know what I mean? So I'm just, all this stuff gets distracting and it makes it hard to be quiet. You got to be quiet to write and to get at something that's truthful. So
Do you write mainly in your apartment or a coffee house?
Only in my apartment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Where it's just, you do anything crazy like, you know, earplugs or anything?
No. Just, you know, I haven't written anything like a novel for a while, but like I was really working hard on this screenplay I was hired to do. And I would take breaks like every 15 minutes and play internet backgammon. So that's as crazy as I get, I guess.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, I don't want you to be late for your thing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much again.
Should I do a Harry call away from the mic?
If you like, yeah, go for it. Thanks, you.